think we're on the air. This morning, it's my privilege to read the declaration and give the announcements for ULT. And it's a very interesting, wonderful Sunday in that we are ending our summer study class for the summer, and we are in transition toward the winter study class. And the activities all pivot around this particular short, sweet, incredibly significant statement. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave at the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. These few short paragraphs are actually the shared agreement that students who associate themselves with the movement, with the cause, use to refer back to make sure that they're doing what they are interested in doing and what they by heart believe to be so, so important. Volunteers keep the building open for the public Wednesday evenings at 5:15. The library opens. It stays open for a couple of hours. There's always a student available to help with reference work that might need to be done. It's a straight-line theosophical collection, but it's not a lending library. Simultaneously on Wednesday, if you would like to purchase something for home use, you can see a student volunteer at the book table. And all of that periodical or books, magazines, pamphlets, whatever it is, they're all available at cost. This is a birthright of humankind, and therefore there should be no profit made on any of the readings of any kind. On Wednesday evenings from 7:30 to 8:30, there's a study class, and as was just said, we're in transition. So that this coming Wednesday night, which would be the final Wednesday in September, we are having a review class in the Bhagavad Gita. The review class has selected paragraphs from the entire book, and please, you can pick up a copy of those paragraphs on the little table that's next to the usher's seat, and that way you can read them in advance of Wednesday night's discussion class if you would like. The following Wednesday night, which will be October 5th, the first Wednesday in October, we're going to shift gears. The winter study class will still be 7:30 to 8:30 on a Wednesday night, but this time the selections will be taken from the Key to Theosophy, a collation of wonderful discussions with questions and answers by HPB and associated students. You can pick up the schedule for the Wednesday night classes from October 5th straight through until the end of December. Again, that paper is available close to the usher's seat. And that way you'll be able to look ahead and prepare for any of the discussions that you might be interested in. This morning, the building opened at 10:30, and again, there was a student at the book table in case someone needed to have questions answered or needed to make a purchase. And our topic for this morning is the last of the Robert Crosby articles. During the summer, we did a very practical study. Gita on the Wednesday nights, and then on Sunday mornings when we were open, we were looking at letters that would be help to companions of Master's Cause. So this morning, that last letter, Nature of Chalyship, letter 6, is what we have on the table for us. Next Sunday morning, the topic will be different. It will be a formal talk. There will be a reading done, and that topic for next Sunday is going to be the Theosophical Movement in the Historical Period. And so that's sure to be a nice kickoff idea for all of us to hold for the coming months, if you will. Now, all of these activities are sustained by voluntary contributions. As the Declaration says, there is no government of any kind. We are not an official organization. Rather, this wonderful experiment, if you will, is in, can we, a group of folks come together as free thinkers, independent individuals, but ally themselves on a cause and a few very, very specific ideas, and then voluntarily come forward to do all of the work and all the effort and all the contributions financially to keep this building and its activities sustained. And it's been a very wonderful and very successful exercise, if you will, in what is brotherhood and volunteering. So you're welcome to join the cause if you would so desire. You can talk to the individual at the book table before or after meetings about that. So, without further ado, our article for this morning, The Nature of Chalyship, is a very interesting article, and we may want to bring our minds back to a couple of terms before we hear the summary. In the late 1800s, the term chela, or chalyship, the term guru, mahatma, master, were really not known in the Western Hemisphere, if you will. And it was part of the effort of H.P. Blavatsky to bring these ideas, to reintroduce them to the souls who were in the West and help the souls in the East to clarify and purify their understanding of the terms. So we know these are Sanskrit terms that came into the English vocabulary at that point. Chela meaning disciple or pupil or a student of a guru or a sage. And the guru is Sanskrit for spiritual teacher, someone who is a master in metaphysical and ethical doctrines. And without further ado, we'll turn our focus in to the Crosby letter exploring these concepts.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome. And in addition to what we just heard, we recommend Wednesday evening stopping at the library at 5:30. It opens till the meeting begins. And there will be a volunteer there to point out to you reference books. And also, let us get into the, shall we say, the meat of the park. And we picked sections of the park that you certainly will understand, and questions afterwards will answer your needs. But don't forget the library. You ask about the ego leaving the astral body. Question to Mr. Crosby. I think the best comprehension of the subject can be had by analogy. When one is said to be asleep, the manus or mind is no longer receiving nor transmitting impressions through the body. He passes into the dreamless state, where he functions as a spiritually self-conscious being until the cycle of return comes to function through the body again. Now, if we regard death as a more complete sleep, a final one for that body, the ego would simply cease forever to function through that body, the linga sharira, or sarira, or form astral, would immediately begin to disintegrate, remaining with the body until its last particle, except the skeleton, is dissipated. The ego, however, is no more tied to the one than to the other. The kama rupa, or desire form, aggregates itself from the skandhas, or tendencies of the lower nature, clothed in astral matter, not the linga sarira, and the ego ascends to devakan, clothed in his highest essence. Further down, if it is remembered that the real man is the perceiver of all states, the different states will simply mean his perception on different planes. Okay. He finally leaves his lower principles or instruments. He has no further perception of those sorts, but has others of a higher sort. He never ceases to perceive while in manifestation on any plane. He simply changes the direction of the perception. While occupying a body and during waking hours, he's affected by the stimuli received through the body. After the body sleeps, he's affected by the repetition of the stimuli more or less during the dream. These die out, and he's free as ego on a still higher plane. At death, these have a wide range, each of the lower principles beginning to disintegrate immediately upon the death of the body, for it was the field of their operation. And it's further, I'll just read one sentence. It says, the body itself has no consciousness, no power perception. Chilaship, or shalaship, does not consist in any kind of eating or drinking. This is reference to the body. In any practices, observances, forms, or ritual, it is an attitude of mind. Now, if we skip over the part about food, most of us have some idea that I am saying so much on this subject because experience has shown that it is so easy for students to slip into bodily observances and stay there. This is the wrong end to begin with. It is best not to make any particular selections as to diet. Take what best agrees with you and sustains your body best. There is nothing in vegetarian diet to create spirituality. The Hindus, who have been vegetarians for centuries, are for the most part degraded, and the better portion have as much difficulty as the Western man in the acquirement of spiritual knowledge. Please note, it is the motive that counts too in anything. If a person stops eating meat in order that he may be, by complying with that condition, can attain to a development he has set before him, he misses the mark and has acquired a selfish motive for the line thus adopted. Finally, the first thing then is to have the right kind of thoughts. The other, and by far the least important, is diet, in which the main thing is to preserve, to eat whatever will keep the body in the best working condition. Sure. It's quite true that the foods of the present time are not ideal. in the future, better products will be had. But they will come from right thinking. Our present work is to think from a right basis and become established in that basis and assist others to do likewise. From this will flow what is in accord with it, from within outward, a natural growth.
Thank you. It's quite a letter, and we can only imagine what the original letter of inquiry was about. But we have a variety of responses from Crosby that give some wonderful hints into the nature of chelaship. I'm sure you came with, oh, there's a fast hand already, way in the back.
On page 2, down at the bottom, as the section that starts as to bodily food, we were just a little confused because most of the information on food was basically depending upon your particular makeup.
Mm-hmm. The question of being a vegan or being a carnivore or an omnivore, someplace in between, apparently was as popular a concern in the late 1800s as it is right now. Karmically, the philosophy states that we are soul, we are spirit, away from the eternal. And that across many, many, many incarnations, across the duration of existence in the manifestation, as thinkers, we have created karma, and we have created habits and tendencies. And the body in which we are experiencing the human state right now is a product of that past karma. In an ideal scenario, were we pure spirit working through matter, were we fully aligned with nature, and by self-evolution we had achieved Mahatmaship, the whole question of food might even be able to be dropped. But at present, and it's in the Gita as well, choose those foods most appropriate to maintain health in the physical body that you're currently using. And so for some of us, that is pure vegetarianism. For others, it is being an omnivore, doing both meat and vegetables and fruit. And it is by trial and error, certainly, that each soul determines how to keep that physical frame as healthy as possible. There may even be cycles of life when that changes. But the nature of this article, we are reminded that it's not about outward practices. It's not about somebody who's eating right for their blood type or following an Ayurvedic style. This is some chelaship is something else. It belongs to soul, mind, heart, spirit, not the physical frame.
Physically, but the impact it has on the perceptions we have while we're awake.
So the invitation is to be mindful, to be alert to emotions and passions. Are we excited by caffeine? Are we excited by sugar? Be mindful in that does the thinking become very, very hazy or blurry and in a carb coma kind of a thing? There's information in the literature that you could research and study. What's the effect of eating various meats on a variety of the animal spectrum? And again, as in the final pages of the Gita, act as seems best to thee. Do your research, become as mindful as possible, and then build a good body for use. Way, way in the back.
To address the implications in the fact that it would only be slightly harmful or delaying if you are eating meat, it is pointed in the philosophy to the fact that at a certain point in chelaship, that individual can no longer eat meat because one picks up the tendencies of the very animal that one is eating.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore they have to be rid of that in order to go on further. So we're all perhaps a mountain and a half away from that, but we should be aware of it. And as you said, do the best you can with the understanding you have.
Do the best you can with the understanding you have, and there's plenty of research going on right now about animal experimentation, conditions of how animals are raised. We are in a wonderful time period to have public access to information so that we can hone our ethics and our motives. But again, the motive is what's important. Are we living through these bodies in order to serve others in all arenas of life, or are we choosing to live through this body and perfect this body for a selfish or self-centered motive? Yeah.
And don't forget the date. At that date and prior to it, there was no United States Department of Agriculture. There was no Health Department. Our government began to pay attention to how food was prepared and delivered to the public. Prior to that, all kinds of things happened. In addition, as it refers to what we're reading about, it's quite an uproar, let alone concern about whether it was meat or vegetarian.
That's true, and that's an ongoing theme. It's touched on in the Gita, which is over 5,000 years old. You can listen to radio interviews right now and see that the same struggle is going on. Yes?
And regardless of what kind of food one chooses to eat, in our age, part of the karma of our age, we need to be particularly aware of how the food is manufactured.
Yes.
Because even vegetables are grown in certain kinds of soil, there are certain kinds of pesticides, certain hormones and antibiotics are used. And every once in a while, even recently, there are articles and news breaks that the FDA is recalling certain kinds of foods that are now known to produce diseases because of the way they were manufactured. So, we need to be even more mindful of chemical alterations of whatever food we eat.
We have to be very mindful of that for sure, in terms of preservatives, antibiotics, any number of chemicals, additives. And we can extend that a bit. We need to be mindful of that and very, very aware that within our own sphere of influence, within our own city, within our own metropolitan area, there are, quote, food deserts. There are areas in which human beings cannot get readily to a supermarket and do not have the wherewithal to pay for the public transportation to get to those supermarkets. So there's layer upon layer upon layer of food issues. And again, if we are mindful of it, we begin where we're planted in our own homes, and then begin to extend that thinking to care for and about all of the humans within the sphere of our influence, everyone that we can help and assist. Yeah.
As you mentioned, we have a bounty of facts on the internet that can help us. And we recently came across something that staggered us, since we think vegetables are the most fun in the whole world. Even cutting them up is fun. We always thought the fresh vegetable was the freshest you could get. And saw an article recently that canned vegetables, if they're done by a reputable company, are fresher because they're done immediately after picking. So we never know if what we already know is incorrect.
Mm-hmm. So the key is to remain critically aware. And before we consider cans, consider frozen, flash frozen things. But again, that thinking is still of the physical plane, isn't it? And if we catch ourselves obsessing about the physical plane and the food we're putting in our bodies, if we take just a little bit to concentrate and contemplate, how is that analogous to what we need to be doing for our heart and mind and soul? What kind of nourishment are we focused on at those planes? And again, it's very natural. It's a 5,000-year cycle of worrying about what kind of food is best, but that's pertaining to the physical, and we can transmute that. We can flip it up and say, oh, wait a minute, what's the metaphysical application of the same concern? Way, way in the back.
And that is so beautifully said on the bottom of page 2, over the 3, that the pure bodily functions are of far less importance than what a man thinks and feels, what desires he encourages in his mind and allows to take root and grow there.
HPB's words, ancient teachings, if you will. And that's not license to go out and be a gourmet, you know, or a glutton. But truly, the physical is the least of it. Oh, I'm sorry, there's a hand here.
But there is only one existence, and that existence is in the moment. It's right now. That's when we exist. So even though the physical is not important, it's an indicator for us to pay attention. And we're told to be self-sufficient, you know, in all aspects of our life. And we came across this idea that 75% of the food, of the fresh food that we eat, is irradiated. It's put through radiation to kill all the bacteria and so forth. So there's things that we don't know because we've lost contact with that moment. We are busy doing, we're not paying attention to the moment we're living.
Mm-hmm. And I guess it's a trade-off, isn't it? In that with the irradiation and the other processes that food goes through, there are those karmically who have the time and the interest and the energy and the wealth to be totally self-sustaining, to grow tilapia fish in water tanks so that their water and excrement feeds the plants that they're growing in their greenhouse, and then the water recycles back through the system and again takes care of the fish. There are individuals raising their own fish, their own vegetables, their own fruit in their backyards. But to be perfectly honest, knowing and loving one of those individuals very dearly, that's about all that individual does. It's a very different use of life, very different use of motive. So, you know, the old phrase, you bloom where you're planted. Make a decision about how to stay as healthy as you can, because having a healthy instrument, having the body, means that you can service and educate others. Way, way in the back.
City that, and these are very quiet, volunteer.
it's very, very true that it's mind over matter, isn't it? It's soul over the physical. So that how we bring ourselves to the process of eating, preparing food, serving food, growing food, etc., is an analogy on a very basic, observable plane of what can also be done internally and metaphysically on much higher planes. Yes.
I just wanted to add one other point in regard to food deserts and so forth, that the Mormon Church has throughout the country warehouses
mm-hmm.
where they store canned foods that are available at cost, I mean just the cost of production, no profit, and they're available to anyone. You don't have to be a Mormon to purchase those foods. We point that out because we think it's a good example of having the right motive, not just in eating, but making food available to other men.
That's a good example from current events. Very, your hand was up, I believe.
Sure. So that sentence where HPV says the purely bodily functions are of far less importance than what a man thinks and feels. And sometimes when considering theosophical ideas, we often talk about one needs to control his emotions.
Mm.
And of course, it's a lot easier to control a well-raised poodle than an out-of-control whatever else there might be, pit bull or something. And the reason why we bring that up is because just as, you know, depending on what you feed your physical body, so too, what you feed your emotions
mm-hmm.
plays into how you're able to use your mind and how much effort you need to put into controlling your emotions. So the food for the emotions, meant very simply, is the arts, it's color, it's music, it's surrounding yourself with beauty. External beauty affects us inwardly. It evokes from within us a sense of harmony on the animal, you know, in the animal nature. You know, they say that music calms the savage beast. And the more calm the savage beast is, the more free the mind is to move into the universal.
The references made to sound, to color, to art, poetry, can we add to that list, inspirational readings, how we create the environment within our homes, within our workplaces, within a meeting room such as this is so crucial. What we bring in the door here in terms of emotional baggage from the outside world can impact every thinker in this room, can't it? So this food for the soul, food for the body, and the motive to purify and uplift is very, very important. Madison Avenue knows all about it. The color of paint used in doctors' waiting rooms. The color of paint and design used in a gambling casino. All of these things are carefully, carefully weighed and applied. Because what the speaker just alluded to, surrounding the physical senses, creating external stimuli that will support a centered existence, is well known. Yeah.
While all those things are true, HPB have written that a human being could be in a prison.
Yes.
And yet the mind is still free to think and feel as it chooses. And so it's interesting that Mr. Crosby begins this article on chandlership with a discussion of how the ego perceives on different planes.
Mm-hmm.
So our question is, doesn't that suggest that the way we think and feel has much more impact on our perception and what we ultimately will perceive on other planes than does any physical practice?
The question pertains to that first long paragraph on page one of the reading with states of consciousness and the use of mind principle, the fact that we are mind beings. And that attitude, that subject matter, is key to the nature of chelaship. It is key to a spiritual experience. So what HPB was bringing forth in the late 1800s was a fact in nature that there is mind, there is beingness, that it expresses in the human kingdom in a hierarchy of ways or a spectrum of ways, however you want to envision that, that there's a spectrum of powers available and observable sometimes among chelas or students, observable among gurus who may or may not be self-acclaiming, if you will, that the entire process is one of purifying, clarifying the use of mind and the lower instruments until finally and truly soul is able to gain a great state. The Mahatma is able to focus completely, reside, exist solely through the highest monastic essence we can imagine, and such a one has total command and rapport over great nature, still within the bounds of karma, but certainly this opening paragraph is crucial to understanding the nature of the human, the states through which that mind being works, and what the potential is in the long run in the what we call after death states, after an incarnation. Yeah.
Just like you were saying, when you are in a doctor's office, there's certain colors that can sit, or a casino, that can certain colors in a certain atmosphere that sit certain people in a certain mode. On a higher level than that, could a person or persons put together a projection that you can project that will cause you to act in a certain way and think a certain way to control you?
Maybe we call it television.
Right.
I mean, some of the shows that the general public are watching in theaters, but more and more in TV and small handheld devices. If that's the way that mind is focused, and if that mind passively goes with whatever that script or scene is, then that mind and that being can be greatly swayed. Propaganda during World War II, I can't think of the woman's name. There was a German cinematographer who used Olympic footage to do the propaganda for the Hitler Aryan race. And people were shown that film over and over and over again. So yes, the answer is yes, for sure. Way, way in the back.
To the point you were making earlier about that first paragraph, we think it's perfectly answered in the very beginning of the paragraph on page 2, where it's telling us chelaship is an attitude of mind. That's all. I mean, that's enough, but that's all.
Chelaship is an attitude of mind, and this wisdom exists behind many of the world's great religions, doesn't it? Because the quote in the next couple of lines, another teacher, and we know this would be Christianity, "Seek ye first the kingdom of heaven, and all the rest will be added unto you." So first and foremost in life, seek the spiritual. Seek what would be ethical, what would be universal, what would be loving of all substance and all creatures. And as you focus your thinking in, what's the best I can do within these conditions? What is the kindest thought to be held in this scenario? How can I see in the other's behavior and demeanor the kind word they may need? And in living like that, turning within, trying to figure things out, trying to serve spiritually, everything else will fall into line and come. So chelaship, probably, if like probationary chaelorship, pre-chaelorship, however we want to say that, probably begins with the stirring, that ethical knowledge from within, there's more to life than just this, and how the heck do I help it? There's the beginning of it. Yeah.
It's not directly brought up in this letter, but it is mentioned elsewhere. Usually when a person thinks of being a chela or a disciple of a guru, they're referring to some kind of direct relationship.
Yeah.
They want to go to India, they want to go out to California, they want to go to a retreat. They have to sit at the close proximity there's a relationship. So how does that fit into the nature of real chaelorship? What is the real relationship? What can be a real relationship between a teacher and a disciple?
In the key, which I don't have with me, on page 291 in the key, this is the quote. When two minds are sympathetically related and the instruments, the body and the different planes through which they function are tuned to respond magnetically and electronically to one another, there is nothing which will prevent the transmission of thoughts from one to the other at will. The only difference that can exist between two minds is a difference of state. So theosophically, what is being said, and it stands to reason, if that first theosophical premise, that first proposition, that all soul emanates from one source, one beingness, and then gradually radiates through the lower influences and the lower forms that we've come to accept as human life. If we're all from that one source, and we all tune into the same essence, the same thought focus and hold it, and really desire to comprehend what all the great religious teachers were bringing forth. Where's the commonality? What is universal truth? What is it to be all you can be to help the planet and all else? If that's the focus, then theosophically, that truth, two minds are sympathetically related, and the instruments through which they function are tuned to respond magnetically and electronically to one another. Theosophically, the relationship is as Krishna to Arjuna, the higher self to the lower self. It's within. And if we are all one, as we tune in and raise the frequency, we are in touch, we are at one with a stream of a monastic being, of a Mahatma, way, way in the back.
And that explains why we keep coming to all these meetings. Somebody said once, you don't really need to be here, do you? I mean, you could study the books at home. We, as you said about propaganda, how influential it is, it's the attitude of mind of our fellow, quote, chelas, that are like a virus to us. They feed us. They encourage us. We get our strength by this repetition of being around each other.
And in the event karma takes us away, if you've had the experience of being away for a period of time, 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, a year, whatever, the sense of coming home to a gathering like this, the sense of looking in the eyes of other humans and saying, we are one, we really are, and what great power must there be as we come together in this loving force of highly motivated, how do I live my best life together? How do we do that together? And therefore, what can we do for the all, for the whole. And that is beyond valuable. Yeah.
In the quote, in the key
yeah.
of the term electronics was mentioned, and in electronics, the frequency, the potency of the electronic part can be enhanced dramatically by capacitors and so forth. So when it comes to do we need to come here, and what we see over time is the association with other human beings thinking along the same lines raises the frequency and the power of our individual thought much greater to those planes that we would need to be at than if we studied alone. And the reverse is true, that our attendance individually increases the collective frequency of the group. That's just something you sense and know over time.
And over time, if each of us just remembers for a little bit, how many times have we sat in a chair in one of the classes and had a puzzlement, or we arrived with a question of practical life thinking, oh, I wish I knew how best to look at this scenario. And we sit in the chair, and the next thing you know, somebody else asks exactly the same question. Or two or three individuals quote something, cite something, make an observation, and it's exactly what we needed to hear or read or go look up. The collectivity is so important, and what's so much fun is, my goodness, how old is the Key to Theosophy now? Over 100 years old. Just now, in medical science, do we more fully understand magnetically, electronically, or electrically how the brain and the body is frequency and vibration and really a poof in terms of physicality? Yeah.
Yeah. And those fundamental principles that we hear every other week, and the idea that the study of the ocean of theosophy that's coming up will learn something about who and what am I and what is my purpose. And there's nothing in there about the food you eat at that particular time. So I'm not disbarred. This is the greatest
mm-hmm.
discovery we could ever make. And here we learn how to separate terms, new definitions, and so on.
Exactly. Exactly. The July 2016 issue of Theosophical Movement that comes from India has an interesting article. It's Gurus and Gurus. And on page 7 of that article is this. An ordinary person becomes a lay chela when he determines to be wise in spiritual matters. At this stage, he receives no direct instructions from the guru, but already there is an unseen link between him and his guru. The inner training of the lay chela is never to give way to vice and also never to act by mere feelings, however good. He must initiate action by combining reason with heart feeling. He will not succeed all at once, but every effort draws him nearer to the invisible guru, whose presence he may feel as he strives to overcome his personality. And therefore, the point is, why go in search? And then the same article has a delightful quote from Light on the Path, a little devotional book that's unbelievable. And that quote is, "No man is your enemy. No man is your friend. All alike are your teachers." So the nature of chelaship, the nature of living to be aware, to be mindful, to be open to brotherhood, and all human beings become part of the essence of teacher one to the other and back again. Your hand was up or no?
Yeah.
Oh, yours was, okay.
Yes. When you was getting back to the question, getting back to what you were saying about coming together and being understanding of each other, there, one time I had faced a situation with being an individual and it was a question asked and my answer was different than the other person's answer, but I told them neither one of us is wrong because your situation and your upbringing was different than mine, so my answer is going to be different than yours. So I told the individual, I said, you're right and I'm right.
Mm-hmm.
And we came to a realization, we came and looked at both situations, and it was true.
It is true. And it's like the old parable about the seven blind men and the elephant. Each one comes to the elephant in a different angle, and therefore elephant means seven different things to these seven different blind people that are trying to sense what an elephant is. And the adage that we often use with children, between your truth and his truth, someplace in the middle is the absolute truth. So let's put it together and try to look at something from both sides and find how we can both be right. Yeah.
Well, of course, there are relative truths based on our different conditions and experiences. But if we learn in theosophy that there is a certain identity of our spirituality and certain things of human beings that are common to all human beings, then there must be a universal truth. So it's not always necessarily a compromise.
Mm-hmm.
Relative opinions, but trying to look together as to what are those universal truths that apply to all situations.
So we seek the universal truth that applies in all situations at the same time that we struggle to bring our own carnal nature under the control of will so that we stay centered enough to be compassionate with the erroneous thought and actions of someone else, so that we observe and we hold the universal truth and use that as a firm ruler while we're trying to understand where somebody else is coming from and how to ask the right question or pose the right scenario so they too can turn toward the universal truth instead of their relative truth. Your hand's been up and down. Yeah.
It states that our motive and attitude is more important than anything.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that we stumble and we have difficulty maintaining that. And we are told that there are some devotional books that really can help us keep our attitude and keep our motive as pure as possible. And we just got to finish reading it this summer. Again, the Bhagavad Gita. In the weakest of moments, it's always there to really show how to maintain that attitude and motive.
The Bhagavad Gita is a lovely little book. It's over 5,000 years old now. And indeed, if you bring that Gita to most health practitioners, whether they're dealing with mind or body, they will find their own aspects of their own professional training hearkening back to the pages of that little book. But there are other little books also that may appeal to you. You know, we spend a lot of time talking about food and how scandically each of us is in working through a different physical body, and that body may need different things at different times. So too, in terms of devotional books, please feel free in library hours or at the book table to look at The Voice of the Silence, The Light on the Path, the Gita notes, if you will. There are the quotation books, daily quotes from the readings of HPB, from the readings of William Q. Judge, from Crosby. There are little pamphlets that are easy to slip into a pocket. Whatever they are, whatever you need, whatever spiritual nourishment you need in the moment, just opening a little book and letting it just fall to the right place and to read it and consider it. Not to chant it, not to passively accept it, but to read the words, read into the words, and really consider it. Way in the back.
And to review the things that as a child moved you spiritually and to look at them theosophically. For example, the Lord's Prayer. How many times as a child did we repeat it without ever realizing what we were saying? Forgive us our debts as we forgive the debts of others. And we wonder what's going wrong in our lives.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes, as children, we're taught to recite things, particular psalms, particular prayers, particular anthems, pledges, etc. And it's really a hoot to hear a 3, 4, 5-year-old sometimes mustering together nonsense syllables because they think they know what the words are. But the kids get so used to this rote chanting and it's mindless. The key is, in that attitude of mind, is to drop the passivity, to quiet the physical, including through the use of food and other intake, and then to consider, really consider by heart, what is potential, what is possible. Our time is just about gone, and the helping letters of William Q. Judge and Crosby have come to a close for another season, but there are wonderful things available. If this subject of what it is to be a chela, what it is to be disciplined, to be a disciple, how to tune one's heart and mind to the eternal universal in order to better all of great nature, there's a pamphlet, it's a HPB's pamphlet number 16, Teachers and Disciples. There are lots of articles in here going through all the different aspects of what she had to say about pure chelaship, about following the path that she showed, and about how to identify false gurus, which is really, really important. And again, TM from July 2016, the first article is Guru and Gurus. So Wednesday night, we have the review class of the Gita, and yes, indeed, one of the most priceless devotional books ever in consideration. Pick up your copy, if you will, of the selections from the entire little text, and we'll look at it together on Wednesday night, 7:30 sharp. Have a great day.